Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. It's Movie Geeks United, a great, exciting show for you guys tonight. Two actresses. First up, actress Greta Gerwig, whose new film is called Frances Ha. And then towards the end of the show, Teresa Palmer, who has a new movie out called Wish You Were Here. That'll be a little bit later, both of those conversations. First of all, hi, guys. How you doing?
We're doing good. How are you?
Good, good. I want to ask about After Earth. Did you venture off and watch that, Jerry?
No. I mean, life is very short. Why is Will Smith and Jada Smith think that we're interested in their children? I think that's a legitimate question at this point.
I think this is really disgusting. Yeah, I mean, they're really trying to force their hand on this kid, you know?
Both of the... What? That's disgusting. You're going to force your kids on us? Really? I mean, that's just, it's embarrassing. The Smiths have basically decided, oh, we're the Kardashians now. I think that's a legitimate thing to say at this point. I mean, we're the Kardashians of Hollywood, of the movie business.
I just don't think that kid I'm really only familiar with Jaden. But I just don't think that he's really displayed any kind of, like, any real reason to go see anything with him in it. I mean, but they're obviously trying to groom him for, you know, superstardom or whatever.
Okay, all right. They're trying to groom him. What about all the other child actors or all the other actors, period, actors and actresses who are out there struggling? Oh, mommy and daddy are famous, even though the kids don't really have any talent, as far as I can see. Anyone could have played his son in Pursuit of Happiness, and anyone could have played in the Karate Kid remake, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's really a new low. I mean, come on.
I also think that a lot of Hollywood these days is working on a certain sense of nepotism. I mean, maybe this has always been going on, but I don't think it has.
Not like this. I think Manola Dargis in her review said, you know, most kids get like a car or something or whatever. We're going to give you a motion picture.
This is us here. That is the tail somewhere in this area. It's approximately 100 kilometers from here. We need that beacon. You understand? You are going to retrieve that beacon, or we are going to die. Do you understand? Repeat what I just said to you.
I have to go retrieve the beacon, or we're going to die.
You know, it's really funny. You had two movies come out this weekend, and both seem like they are directed by the same guy. Now You See Me... I had no idea that the guy who did the Hulk and what's the Clash of the Titans remake disaster, Louis Leterrier, directed it until they said, oh, it's directed by him. That movie could have easily been directed by M. Night Shyamalan because it relies on a twist. I mean, I'm sorry. Movies, if you want people to go back and watch them, if the twist is the high point of your film, if that's your thing,
then,
go home.
It's not going to have much rewatchability.
Yeah, I completely agree. Let someone else do the movie, please. But this, I think this thing with Will Smith is embarrassing. I really do.
Actually, the children of movie stars have always said that their biggest obstacle is trying to form an identity of their own and get out from the shadow of their famous parent. It seems to be the exact opposite with Jaden Smith. He seems to be the one that's forced to embrace it.
Yeah. That's true.
I mean, you're trying to get out. I mean, daddy's there. I mean, and I like Will Smith. I really do, but this is...
I didn't mind it in Pursuit of Happiness, though.
It works there, I think, because we didn't... I mean, it seemed like a one-shot deal, but it's a trend now with them.
Now they're... The thing is, they're now really trying to make him into, like, a huge star. That's I thought that was, I agree that it was okay in Pursuit of Happiness, you know, but I don't think that kid has whatever it is. I don't think that he's very interesting.
The movie got crucified.
I think that was coming. I think anyone who knew that, you knew that was coming. But, I mean, even like Lloyd Bridges and Jeff Bridges, I think we would have bought it. They would have done this maybe in another time. But here it just seems like the kid doesn't have any talent. Let's be very honest here. This kid is only in this movie because of who his parents are, who his father is. And it's got to be, really, I don't care who you are, if you're an actor, an actress, this movie must seem like a punch in the gut for you. You're working your ass off, and this kid gets the big break because of who daddy is? Come on.
I get that. It did get crucified, and it only got like a couple of positive responses, one of which was from Matt Zoller Seitz.
And David Edelstein, for that matter.
Well, I read Matt's review of it, and... It turned me off even more to the movie because his review seemed to talk about all of these life lessons that it teaches, and nothing is more nauseating than a movie that sets out to teach you a thing or two.
I agree.
Especially one from M. Night Shyamalan. So, all of us have seen what premiered last week, which was Behind the Candelabra, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. My first question, do you think it could have been successful as a theatrical release?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I thought that it felt like a theatrical movie pretty much to me. I mean, it looked like a theatrical movie. It felt like one, you know. The only thing that had even like a tiny bit of TV movie to it was maybe something about the title or maybe just the subject matter in general, but that was it. Otherwise, it was completely screen worthy.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason this couldn't have been in the theater, and it's a good. I like though how he says he's moving into television now. He's not retiring, and I think that's good because I think he's a natural wherever he goes. I'm Soderbergh, and I do think we're going to see another movie by him in a couple of years. But it's really funny. I was watching Magic Mike again the night before, and you can't help but think Soderbergh is even better now in the last couple of years than he was in the beginning or in the middle. I mean, he just keeps getting better and better.
He's definitely had a major, major run of very, very good movies.
It's amazing.
You know.
He's never lost his adventurous spirit as a filmmaker.
Yeah, and this is a very challenging movie. This is not an easy movie to get into. And I'm wondering, this is a very challenging... I mean, first of all, if you don't like Liberace, I don't know if you're like this movie. If you're not interested in the subject matter, probably not. But it's so fascinating, regardless, to watch these two actors. And I guess there's going to be just Emmy nominations all over the board for this one.
I don't know if they built those sets or if they had. I don't know, but the recreation of Liberace's lifestyle is unbelievable. I mean, the
mm-hmm.
costumes, the set decoration, everything is just unbelievable.
I think it's
top.
Yeah, I
top
agree.
Top stuff.
That's. I mean, I think all the as far as like physical appearance of the movie and everything. It's just beautiful. What I also like about it, it's not a very likable portrait of him, though. That's what I really like. It is very even-handed. This is not a celebration of anything. It's a very even-handed, matter-of-fact, almost in-your-face story of these two gentlemen.
It's not afraid to show the their flaws in a major way.
I'm so sorry. I'm so informal. So happy you all could come.
Don't these things belong in an oven?
Oh, he's so mean to my babies. I mean, this is my family. And this is baby boy. Baby boy. He's very old. He's deaf. He's blind. I'm a seeing eye person.
You know, I could get something to help clear up his eyes.
Scott works with animals.
Oh.
Well, I worked for a vet. You know, for a while, and we had a lot of poodles with eye problems.
Oh, that would be fabulous. No one's been able to help my little baby boy. You know, I hate to see him suffer. I think my favorite review is from San Francisco, when they said Liberace was no Rubenstein. But then Rubenstein is no Liberace.
I think the use of stars was important because it kind of, for people that would be uncomfortable watching intimate homosexual encounters.
Right.
It softened somewhat by the novelty of seeing two actors, one in particular, Michael Douglas, who is so pronounced in his
mm-hmm.
heterosexuality in a lot of
right.
his popular roles. Yeah, I think that makes it more palatable for some viewers. But even so, it doesn't sugarcoat the creepiness of that relationship at times.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I agree.
The fact that he wanted to remake him in his own image and,
mm-hmm.
and the father-son dynamic at play. And it has so many colors in it, and it's also very funny, and it pays attention to the camp of Liberace's
mm-hmm.
existence.
Right.
But then it finds a deep kind of emotional core in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's the most emotional movie Steven Soderbergh's made for me, and I think it's the best performed movie of the year and the best performance I think Matt Damon's ever given. I mean, I was really bowled over by a lot of elements in it.
Mm-hmm. I thought the plastic surgery, the whole element of that was so disturbing. I mean, hats off for making that really just a horrifying process. I mean, just...
And then, of course, Rob Lowe. We would be remiss if we didn't mention
Rob
Lowe.
Oh, no, he was
Lowe.
Good. He was great.
Incredible...
I mean, he was a nut.
That was an incredible supporting performance.
Yeah.
Definitely. I liked how the movie too was unexpectedly sweet in some moments too, mm-hmm. even though it does get down and dirty and
mm-hmm.
it surprises you with its portrayal of the kinder aspects of the
right.
relationship between them. Even later on in the film, you know, we get a look at, you know, we get a little respite from the bickering back and forth. And I was really glad too that the movie didn't descend into some kind of courtroom drama or something like that.
Oh, thank God.
Could have easily gone into that whole thing, but the camera doesn't go into even one courtroom, I don't think. So that was refreshing, too. But interestingly enough, Marvin Hamlisch's last
right.
contribution to movies, adapting
yeah.
the score. So
you know, and watching
it,
it reminded me about how stodgy Phil Spector was in comparison to it.
Yeah.
It really brought forth what a failure Phil Spector movie was.
I completely agree with that, though. Yeah, definitely. Like, Phil Spector, that movie didn't have nearly as much life to it as Behind the Candelabra did.
And it's a shame that, I mean, I know they're going to campaign for Matt Damon to win Best Supporting Actor, and I know they're probably both going to win Emmys, but it's a shame that they can't be both nominated for Best Actor, because it really is a two-hander. I mean,
right.
very evenly split between the two of them. Yeah.
I don't think either one of them deserves to be campaigned as Supporting Actor. I think that's absurd.
Mm-hmm.
They're both. I mean, why can't you know? It has two leads. Let's just,
right.
Let's say what it is.
Because they want. Because they want both of them to win.
Well, it's disingenuous and it's not fair. Actually, it's not fair to the people who actually give real supporting performances.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it so much that I wasn't even annoyed by the presence of Dan Aykroyd.
I was watching it. I was like, "Is Jamie grinding his teeth yet?" I kept thinking.
And by the way, wasn't Michael Douglas's miming of the piano incredible? I mean, I thought he did an amazing job of miming the piano for this movie.
Yeah, he really did.
They didn't try and trick it out or anything. But you really got a chance to see him. See him do it, and boy, he really it was. And of course, I was completely shocked too the first time you see. And this is a little bit of a spoiler, I guess, if you haven't seen it. But I figure everybody's probably seen it by now. But when you see Liberace with his wig off,
yeah,
that just completely.
Right,
floored me. I couldn't believe it.
I had no idea about that. So I was like, wow.
what a great part. I mean, it's a great role. Well, I guess this is a good opportunity to introduce our first interview.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean did our first interview for us with actress Greta Gerwig. First of all, Dean, what was it like? What was the experience like to talk to her?
Well, it was of course nerve wracking, but it was the fulfillment of a dream of mine. She's the only major actor that I'm really just. I was really just dying to talk to you, and you know, even while it was going on, I was like, struggling to enjoy the moment, but I said, "Well, I just got to be professional and just barrel on through with this interview." And I was thinking, you know, that we were only going to have like 20 minutes with her, but it ended up being a little bit longer.
Double that time.
Yeah, it sounds that way.
But, She was very generous with her time, and it went by like a flash, you know, for me. So I just said, well, I'll enjoy it more when I get to hear it, you know, when it's over with. But she was, you know, extremely extremely kind and giving. And
I don't think she's ever been as comfortable in front of the camera as she is in Frances Ha. I think in Frances Ha, she's completely unguarded. She completely, and she's just allowed to do what she wants, more so than in Hannah Takes the Stairs or Nights and Weekends or in Greenberg. I think she just, like, this is it. I'm going to do everything I want to do, and it is a success. I mean, she is really allowed to run the whole spectrum of everything, and it is quite something to behold on the screen.
Okay, so with that intro, the movie is Frances Ha, which is her latest release. It's currently in limited release in theaters nationwide. Here's Greta.
I like it when movies pay attention to female friendships. Is this something that you sought to remedy with this movie? I mean, the fact that there are so few female friendships actually dramatized on screen these days?
Well, you know, what's interesting was actually it felt very organic in that – both structurally and content-wise, Noah and I don't say, we're going to write a movie about this, and then do that. We kind of see the movie we're going to write by what our characters seem to be talking about. And that sounds kind of goofy and artsy-fartsy, but it is actually how we do it. And I thought what I was really excited by was that it was the movie that these characters seemed to want, as opposed to something that was dictated by us, and that it really was in its bones a story about ambition and friendship that had no romantic contingent in it, just because that wasn't the story. And I think so often when women are in films and represented in films, it's like that's the only thing that they ever have done in their lives, is fall in love, not fall in love, or be sad about not being in love, or be happy about being in love. And I just feel like that's just not how I see the world. And it's not that it was a thesis statement that we set out to say, like, oh, now we're going to make this movie for this thesis statement. And it was just like, when we sat down to write it, it just wasn't there. It just wasn't part of it. And that just seems to me to be a closer analogy to the way the world actually is, as opposed to, like, whenever I see these movies, I'm like, is all we do kiss people? Is that all women ever do?
I know. I mean, you know, I find myself longing to see more movies like this. Have you ever heard of the Bechdel test? Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the one about the how many women have names, do they ever talk to each other, do they ever talk to each other about anything other than men?
Yes, and most movies fail that test, you know, pretty horribly. So that was just one of the most refreshing things about Francis Ha, on top of the fact that, you know, the movie is so incredibly funny and even romantic in its own way, because it's sort of a romance with the city of New York in a lot of ways. That, you know, Woody Allen's Manhattan was an influence on the film, or would you say it was an influence?
Well, we definitely, obviously you can't shoot a movie in black and white in New York without thinking about Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly Manhattan, and I mean, Broadway, Danny Rose, and Stardust Memories, they're beautiful. They look amazing. They're emotional and nostalgic. And, I mean, I've always loved them. But we never talked about, like, specifically getting the kind of, you know, in some ways, the Gordon Willis photography in Manhattan, it's so gorgeous. But it's like, you know, he's really photographing the city from these, I mean, now iconic, but, like, he's really going there with photographing, like, the big, perfect shots of the city. And we weren't doing those shots, but we were lovingly shooting the corners of the city that this character is in. For us, it was also, like, the difference between the way New York is photographed and then photographing Paris in, like, the saddest sequence in Paris. We wanted it to be, like, the opposite of every other Parisian movie, or any other moment where a character would go to Paris in any other movie. It would work out so much better, and in ours, it's like the total bust. And the only time we ever actually talked about Woody Allen specifically was when we were shooting in Paris, and there's a shot of her sitting on the stain, trying to light a cigarette, and, like, because she's trying to have her moment where she smokes a cigarette in Paris, and the lighter isn't working. There's not enough fluid in the lighter, and then it's like, oh, even this doesn't work. And she gets up, and as she gets up, you see that her body was obscuring the Eiffel Tower. So that shot actually talked about, Noah was like, it's a mid-80s Woody Allen joke. For some reason, that joke made us laugh so hard while we were shooting it. And I don't think we get to get an audible laugh, like, while we're in a movie theater. But, I mean, that was really the only time we ever talked about Woody Allen specifically. It was, like, getting that moment of, and there's the Eiffel Tower, and she missed it.
I wanted to also touch on the whole Francois Truffaut connection that's going on in the movie with the Georges de la Rue scoring from all the other Truffaut movies. How was that decision settled upon?
That was really in post-production. That was not something we talked about beforehand. And originally, he and the editor put in the Georges de la Rue music as temp music, really. And then we loved it so much. And it was seemed like the movie could hold it. And we talked about trying to get other people to score the movie, but then we thought, this movie can hold the record, you know? Like, might as well use this. And it's so great, and why are we making our lives more complicated than it needs to be? And so we decided we would just stick with it. And I think, you know, I think it's one of those things that, like, the people who know that it's Georges de la Rue know, and, you know, they feel the Truffaut reference, and the people who don't know just experience it as seamless with the movie. And it's beautiful music. I mean, it's so lovely and simple and melancholy. And then, you know, the same is true of the Nielsen, Perry Nielsen that we use, and then combining that with the big music of, like, David Bowie and Hot Chocolate and T-Rex and
Paul McCartney. Yeah, I love the use of Hot Chocolate in it. That was great.
Oh, Hot Chocolate's my fave. I love Hot Chocolate.
That's great. Now, I want to ask, you know, how did you come across Mickey Stumner? I mean, were you guys friends before she got the role in the film?
No, we didn't know each other. She auditioned. She was brilliant. I mean, we auditioned a lot of people, and we actually originally saw her for a different role, and she was so good at that other role that we thought, oh, maybe we shouldn't look at her for Sophie because she's so funny in this role. And then we said, okay, well, we'll just have her try it. And then she was just great. I mean, she was just instantly great and had this quality about her that was, I don't know, she's a great actress. I mean, she's truly a great actress, and I really feel like keep your eye on that one. She's going places.
Absolutely. But
she's just a marvelous actress, and we became really good friends while we were making it.
You really feel that there's a history to that friendship, and it's just, it's wonderful it's portrayed in the film.
How could you not want to date him? He's kind of magic.
Because I'm with Patch.
Patch is the kind of guy who buys a black leather couch and is like, I love it. What are we doing with our day?
I gotta get going around 5.
I thought we were hanging out.
We are.
All day.
I have plans with Patch tonight, I told you.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. I texted that to you.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. Here. We're not doing that. That's shitty. It's not court. I did text you, though.
I believe you.
You don't have to believe me. I did text you.
I read your article that you did, you know, for the New York Times, where you were going through the anatomy of a scene, one particular scene in the film, where you and Mickey are in a bathroom having an argument at a bar.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You went through something like 62 takes with... 43. Okay, 43.
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, was this... these large number of takes, was this something that went all the way through the filming of Francois, and what kind of effect do you think that led to the way that the entire cast, including yourself, of course, worked, and what kind of effect did it have on the performances?
It's really representative of how we made the whole movie. We really did a lot of takes for every scene, and in a way, it was incredibly... incredibly liberating, because we set up the way that the movie was structured and financed, and the way that the shooting went. We shot for 50 days, which is a lot of days. We generally, on an indie, you shoot 20 or 25 days. So we shot twice as long as any movie I've ever worked on. And is it's incredibly liberating because you're not just trying to get it as good as you can in the time frame that you've got. We were trying to make it exactly how we wanted it, which, you know, sometimes you just don't have time to do that. It's just not, and that has its own energy and its own sense when you just need to get the shot and you need to get the performances. It can have a kind of adrenaline that informs it in an interesting way. But I feel that more often than not, it just means that you're not ever quite getting exactly what you want. And I think for Mickey and I, it allowed us to create very controlled, very layered performances, because we would get into this zone where we would make these hairline changes from take to take, and Noah would give us very specific, tiny alterations, and it's almost like it gets you in shape when you watch. I mean, I'm not really an athlete at all, but when you look at like tennis players or gymnasts or something, and a coach says, if you just release your back, or if you just rotate a tiny bit more, it'll change it, and it just transforms everything. It's because they're so supremely in control of what they're doing that a tiny adjustment is the difference between like landing it or not landing it, and that they're able to. It's almost like they're in a state of such high functioning skill that they're both totally on automatic in a way, because it's happening so fast, but they're also able to control it in this minute way, which was what we kind of felt like we got to in France as actors. It felt like we were really in shape. I know there's no other way to say it, and it felt really great, and it's really addicting.
I assume in the future you'll be working, you know, with Noah. You're working on something, you know, with him right now, and I guess you'll keep up with that.
Yeah, I think we will. I mean, hopefully.
Another thing that I loved about the character, and I know that you studied to be a dancer a while ago, and of course Frances is a dancer in the film, but I like how you kind of made her into a very good but not great dancer. Was that kind of something that was that you were conscious of doing?
Yeah. Well, we specifically wanted her to be like, when she's here with a company, that she's not featured. We wanted to, like, in the script, there was a very specific, like, seeing her off stage and in the back. And we wanted her to feel like she's good, but she doesn't have what it takes on some level, which is sad, but we wanted to show someone who's good enough, but not good enough to actually do it for her life.
Right. One of the things that the movie touches on, too, is that kind of sort of post-collegiate kind of malaise that comes through when you you're a couple of years out of school and just trying to make your way through and trying to figure out what you're doing with your life, you know. Did that mirror some of your own experiences coming out of school?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting because we always, I mean, she's very post-college. She's a good 6 years out of college, which is, that's college and a half again, which I think, you know, we were kind of interested in, like, at 23, it's cute. At 27, it's not cute anymore. It becomes like you're about to be an adult who's like this. It's not just like, oh, we're all flailing because we're 23. It's like, now this is actually just your life. And so a little bit, we were sort of interested in, like, does that go too far? But then for me, I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, I experienced there's a way in which I experienced a lot of success in a certain way, not monetarily out of college, but I did experience, I was pretty quickly out of college doing really interesting stuff with really interesting people. And I was very lucky to find Joe Swanberg and Mark and Jay Duplass and Andrew Bulgowski and this group of filmmakers that I fell into, and Ty West, and, you know, a lot of people who were making films for not a lot of money that I was lucky enough to participate in. And I learned so much, and I, you know, loved experimenting and working in all these different ways. And I feel like I really got to, I had a certain level of engagement that I don't think
a lot of people have.
Francis had, certainly the character of Francis. But at the same time, the moments that were most vivid to me of, like, my 20s were the moments where it felt like I was really nowhere, and that I hadn't really achieved anything, and that I didn't know how this was all going to work out. And for some reason, those moments lived inside of me in a way that the feeling of success didn't. And I think that that's probably just my particular psychology, and probably a sign that I need a good therapist. But I, for some reason, that those the successes seemed to be, they were exciting, but they felt elusive. And it also did, I mean, there was a very real thing in my, especially like when I got right out of college for the first few years of, I didn't have health insurance. I didn't have a steady income. I was still working day jobs. So I was still very much not able to support myself. But then on the other hand, I was... You know, I remember I was my first, I think the first review I ever got was, I was reviewed, a movie I did, it was at South by Southwest and was reviewed in Variety. And it was a bad, bad review. They did not like the movie and they did not like me. I remember it says degrading Greta Gerwig. And I was so amazed. I was so amazed that my name was in Variety. Like, I loved it. I was like, oh, my God, my name was printed in Variety, even though it hates me.
So you're part of history, really.
Yeah, exactly. Like, forever. If you ever look me up in the annals of Variety, there I am. Like, I don't know. For me, it's like, in some ways, I took my small victories and ran with them. In other ways, I very much felt like I never lost. I still feel like I'm in a hustle. You don't ever really lose that feeling. I mean, I don't think if you ever, like, any artist or person who is in an unconventional career path, it never feels official. Nobody ever leads you into a secret room and says, Now you're officially doing it, which was, like, part of what actually I wanted to show with Frances, that, like, even though she takes the day job and even though she gives up this version of her dream, that she's still going to make art. And I don't know if anybody's ever going to notice it, but she's going to keep choreographing and she's going to keep engaging with it. And I feel like that's the only thing I know, is that you have to kind of keep doing it because...
Right.
The world will never tell you that they want it, really. So you have to create it for yourself.
You have to bring it to the world before they even know what they want, really. I'm really curious to know. I was really surprised when I was watching the film that your parents show up when your character goes out to California. I guess it's in Sacramento where you grew up. How did you talk your parents into being in the movie, and had they had acting experience at all?
No, they have no acting experience, and it took some doing to talk them into being in the movie, because they didn't want to, they felt uncomfortable with it, and they didn't know what it was going to be like, and I didn't show them the whole script, and but
was that
I,
your actual
I,
house? Is that the actual house that they live in out there?
It's in the neighborhood. It's in the same neighborhood. It's on my street. But they are very... But originally, when we were writing the movie, it was a lot longer. And we would have... If we kept the very long Sacramento version, there were lots of scenes, and we would have cast actors. But because we reduced it to basically a montage of arriving home, having Christmas, taking down Christmas, and leaving, it was almost impressionistic, and it felt like we could... I mean, I really wanted to actually shoot in Sacramento, which was not easy. I mean, it was a pain in the ass to move the entire production to Sacramento for 4 days or something. So,
right. And then, of course, Paris, and then upstate New York, too.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you were all over the place in this film.
It was a mobile movie. But, but it felt like I really wanted to shoot Sacramento because... I think the landscape of Sacramento is very specific, and it's so different from New York. It's really Northern California there. It's flat. It's like the Midwest of California. It's farmland, and it feels like it's like that. It's post World War II houses, the ranch style houses that are low to the ground, and she's literally bigger than the landscape as opposed to in New York. She's dwarfed by the landscape, and I just love Sacramento. I love it. I just think it's beautiful and funny and strange, and it's my favorite place in the world, and I want to make more stuff that takes place there. And I wanted to shoot there. And then once we were shooting there, I was like, well, I just want my parents to be in it. And then we got some of my family friends to be in it, and then like my dentist, actually, we just shot at my dentist, who's like my high school boyfriend's dad, and so it's like that kind of city. It's like really, you know, there's a lot of sprawl, which makes it a bigger city than it actually is, because actually the city of Sacramento, if you grow up in the city, is really small and really. Like, everybody knows everybody, and people will call your mom if they see you, like, driving in a weird part of town or something, and they'll be like, I saw Greta at the Ripley's on Folsom Boulevard. I do not know what she's doing there. And, like, and you're like, why does everybody call my mom? Like, it's stuff like that. And, you know, I love it. Anyway, I love it, and it was so much fun to shoot there. And I've always liked that kind of thing of using something from your life directly, and I felt safe doing it because the movie was so written and so precise and so constructed that it felt like I could almost just put something I could crib directly, as opposed to like I don't know, it's like you know in those Al Hirschfeld drawings when he always used to hide his daughter's name in them.
Oh yeah,
Nina. Yeah,
yeah,
it felt
Nina.
Like that. Like, yeah, it's my Nina.
That's funny. Well, first of all, I just have to say, you know, your acting style to me is extraordinary. It's that sort of naturalistic kind of thing that's going on in all of your performances that just, for me, elevates any movie that you're in, really. In your estimation, how much of your acting style is studied, and how much of it is, you know, just pure instinct?
I feel like as an actor, I've really had a patchwork quilt of influences and inspirations and training. I mean, I've taken a lot of acting classes in my life. I mean, I took a lot of acting classes in Sacramento, both in my high school, and there was a man who ran an acting studio that I took classes from, and he would put on these productions of classic plays, and often he would be in them. but then I would get to play. I was in The Spiegel, and I was in a lot of, you know, I mean, I was like in big Eugene O'Neill plays, and like, and they were very small, and they were black box theater, but I was doing all these, I mean, it was really kind of amazing. I got to do all these different cards, and then I also did it from musical theater, community theater. So, and then I did a ton of acting when I was in college. And so, in a way, I feel like my background is much closer to more of a hammy vaudevillian type of background, in a way. So it's kind of odd when people ask me about this naturalistic acting, because that was never really what I felt I was good at when I was growing up. I always felt like I was good at, like almost jazz hands acting. And I don't know where it came from. Other than that, I did remember I had a moment in college that was a big kind of light bulb moment, which is, in college, at the theater department at Columbia, to audition for the departmental plays, you had to do a monologue in front of everyone who wanted to audition, and everyone was given 30 seconds to, like, do a bit of a monologue and then get off stage, and then from that they'd post callback lists, and then they'd cast plays. But I remember every year I'd done something that I felt was dramatic or, like, showed my acting. And then I think it was like my senior year, I was like, fuck it. I want to say words that I think are really good. And it's like almost like more that I understand the writing from a writing perspective. And I used a monologue from Kenneth Lonergan's Lobby Hero that is actually supposed to be said by a man. But I just felt like I knew how to say it. It was the only time I've ever gotten a callback for departmental shows. And I was like, oh, my God, it worked. Like, that's it. You need to understand the writing. That's such a, like, and it was not that way of, like the acting was about the writing almost more than it was about emotion. That was a big kind of, like, moment for me where I think I started looking for something else, and I kind of started changing the way I was doing things. But, I mean, really, it feels like a big old mess when I think about, like, my toolbox of what I can use to crack a scene. And there have been times when I'm like, God, I wish I had gone to Juilliard and really knew what the fuck I was doing. but in reality, I think for me, even if you do, I'm not saying, you know, obviously Juilliard is an amazing place, and there are amazing places where you can go and train, and it's incredibly helpful, and it can really give you a base of technique. But I also think that, you know, whether you do that or you don't do that, I feel like so much of acting and writing and directing, you learn by doing, and you can go to school for it, but you have to do it a lot.
You know, obviously your collaboration with Noah is something that's brought out another level to your creativity. I guess I understand that you kind of have a real shorthand way of talking and bouncing ideas off of each other. What is it exactly about Noah and the way his writing and his directing style that clicks with you?
I mean, I so love his films, and I've loved his films and his writing for so long. And actually, when I was in college, I went to go to the New Yorker Humor Festival to go listen to people like Steve Martin and for people read their pieces. And I knew he was reading, and he was reading one of his New Yorker pieces at the New Yorker Film Festival. And I don't know. I mean, and that was before Squid and the Whale. I mean, I've really always loved his writing. And I think for me, I felt like I was losing my way a little bit as a writer because I was acting so much, and it was so much fun, but I felt like I just wasn't writing as much as I wanted to. And when I read the script for Greenberg, I knew I would love it, but then I did love it so much, and it made me jealous of his writing in a way. I wanted the part and I wanted to act in it, but I also, it made me want to write and ask to work on this. I felt like I had a couple of years of stored up material that I hadn't been using, and I felt like in a way because he's so exacting and so precise and so demanding of himself as a writer and as a creator, I felt like I had to raise my game, that my first attempt was not good enough, that I had to really dig deeper and find something better and work things over more. And I feel like, but then I also feel like we have this very easy rapport because we both find the same things funny and the same things interesting. And I think, you know, that's something that it just doesn't feel like you get so many of those collaborations in a lifetime. It feels like they're rare. And I think he had that with, and still does have that with Wes Anderson. And I think in the same, I mean, it's a totally different writing relationship, but I think that there's a way in which sometimes, you know, collaborations, they can really, it's like there's such pleasure in finding out that you're better than you thought you were. And I think for me, that was my side of it. And I think he totally was delighted by me finding that. And it was fun for him. And he would always say, he always said that he would, because we wrote a lot of it, actually, the scenes separately, and we'd email the scenes back and forth to each other. And he would say, I would look forward to checking my email because it would be like I was getting an installment in a radio program or something. Like, then what happened? And then what happened? And he would sort of send me these emails like, you know, did you finish the scene yet? Where is it? Like, maybe just keep writing. Like, see what happens. And it was like, but it was really, it felt like I was, you know, it's like somebody had this arena and an audience, and then he, you know, obviously he was writing things to me too. It was just, you know, I don't know. I don't know that you get, I just don't think you get that many of those.
Yeah.
And I definitely feel like I grew so much as a writer from it. And I mean, I feel like between then and now, it was like hugely different for me.
Do you have any, I mean, you know, of course I've seen Nights and Weekends, which you did, which you directed and wrote and starred in, Joe Swanberg, and that's, I think that movie is superb. And I'm curious to know if you have any plans of, if you have it cooking in your mind to return to directing anytime.
Yes, I have that thought cooking. I'm cooking that thought. I really want to, and it's really something I'm gonna go after, and I don't know why it's so. I think some people are born with a lot of confidence to just go do that. But for some reason, I feel like I didn't. I mean, I have plenty of confidence, but I think sometimes you have to think yourself into doing something that seems bigger than you are at that particular moment.
You kind of have to work yourself into kind of a frenzy, kind of, in a way.
and you have to kind of feel like you're just going to burst if you don't do it. And I think you almost build up that feeling inside of you, and then you're like, I have to do it. I have to do it because otherwise I will never forgive myself. And so, I mean, that's probably the least efficient way to go about anything. I mean, there are plenty of people who just non-neurotically go do things and accomplish things. But for me, I have to make it some painful, silly, unnecessary choice. I'm also competitive, and you know, I see people I admire doing things, and then I think it's also, I mean, this is probably terrible too, but because I'm competitive, I also find myself when I read movie reviews, sometimes I'm like, oh no, I'm jealous of that director, but it's good. I try to let it pop up.
That's funny. I know that you and Noah are working on something. I looked it up on IMDb, and you're working on something called right now it's untitled, but it's called the Public School Project.
It's still being made. I mean, it's still being made. I can't really talk about it. Also, Noah doesn't really like it when I talk about things before they're done. I try not to, because it's like, you know, I think sometimes if you talk about things before they're all the way made, it can mess with your mind a little bit while you're doing
it. Yeah,
it can
jinx it or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's some superstition.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. But I know you're also working on an animated film as well. And that seems very unusual. And I also know that you provide a voice for China. What's it called? China, Illinois? Is that what it's called?
Oh, yeah. China, Illinois. Yeah, I love those guys. That's super fun. They're great. No, it's actually like the coolest job I've ever had. Like, I go in and I do these crazy episodes, and it's so much fun, and I love them. They're so great. Brad Neely's so great, and I'm actually really proud of them because I did a voice for the pilot, and it was originally much shorter, and I've really watched them grow as a team, and it's a really weird, fucked up show, but it's really funny, and I think it's just one of those things that I feel like I didn't participate in creating it, but I did feel like I was there from the beginning. So I'm glad that
right.
It's still going and has fans.
Well, I would be remiss if I, you know, I know that some of my our listeners wanted to hear you talk a little bit about both Whit Stillman and your experience with Whit Stillman, which that was another great film, Damsels in Distress, and
thank you.
And Plus you got to dance and you sang in it too.
Yes.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
That was such an unusual performance for you too, because the unusual nature of the dialogue in that film kind of forced you to change your acting style that you're normally known for a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about?
I mean, I love Whit Stillman's movies. Metropolitan, Last Days of Disco, and Barcelona are some of my favorite movies. And I was so excited that he was going to make another one. And I couldn't believe I got to be in it. And, you know, I was a total fangirl about him. And I loved it. I loved seeing that dialogue. And I loved being able to act in a more arch way and not do something that feels contemporary, really, but it felt sort of out of time and almost like
that
wild
of the movie. it didn't feel like it was taking place in no time. Like it felt like the 50s or the 60s, but not really. It's like, it kind of felt like the 80s sometimes. It was very, very unusual film.
The most amazing part was that Whit Stillman thought he was making Animal House. He thought it was like, he did not think it was strange at all. And it was, I love Whit, and I loved working with him, and I'd love to work with him again. And I really like that different kind of acting. It's great.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it won't be another 10 years before we see another Whit Stillman movie. I hope not.
Definitely.
What about working with Woody Allen? Do you have any specific memories? I know that you had a very difficult kind of first meeting with him in some ways.
Well, I mean, it was just very quick and very, I was intimidated, but I was excited. And I mean, I loved working with him because he's my idol, and I really, like, his films were such a huge part of why I wanted to act and make movies, and I loved his writing, and I, you know, his influence on me and my life artistically is immeasurable, and I mean, it's very hard to then audition for that guy if that's the way you feel. Like, it's hard to just do what you do for him, and I think I loved working on the film. I mean, it was amazing. I was in Rome. It was an amazing cast, and it was him. And I know I mean, you know, I wish I could do it again. I mean, I would do any movie with him.
I totally think you fit into his world. You know, I think you completely fit into his world. It would not surprise me at all if you were in a few more of his movies in the future.
I would love it.
Yeah. When I saw that you were in the movie, I was like, oh, that's perfect. I had been waiting for Greta Gerwig to be in the Woody Allen movie. It was fantastic. I know that you have to go, but I really want to thank you for being on our show. I hope that when you do something else, if you think about coming back on the show, and we can just, you know, talk about crazy things like, you know, what movies have you seen recently? Have you seen any good movies recently, by the way?
Stories We Tell by Star Pauly.
I can't wait.
She's pretty great.
Yeah.
I know, she's my favorite. I'm in love with her.
Yes.
She's
amazing. She's amazing. Your movie and Damsels in Distress and Take This Waltz both ended up on my top 10 list last year. So.
Okay, good.
Okay, that was Greta Gerwig. The movie is Frances Ha. For more information about the film, go to francishamovie.com, and it's Frances spelled FrancesHaMovie.com. It's in limited release in theaters right now. I watched this documentary on Richard Pryor Friday night that Marina Zinovich made.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
As her follow-up to the second Polanski doc that she made. I honestly think she just happened upon a great untapped subject for that first Polanski documentary. And since then, she's proven that she's just kind of a middling director, because I wasn't crazy about the second Polanski doc, and I'm certainly not crazy about this Richard Pryor. It feels like cliff notes on Richard Pryor's life.
Right.
It's subtitled Omit the Logic, and that becomes her theme of the movie, which is a way of saying that, you know, there's no way to really understand Richard Pryor. So I think that she looked at her footage and she said, well, you know, I don't have a full round portrait of this man, so
mm-hmm.
I'll just make that my theme, but there's no way to really
understand. Okay.
And we know his life. We know his life pretty intimately already. I mean, he even told it himself in JoJo Dancer.
Right.
And it wasn't. You know, he was one of the most honest people in terms of the demons he was facing,
mm-hmm.
for the most part, in his stand up. But it's an hour and 20-minute documentary about Richard Pryor, and there's very few interviews with people that actually should be in it. I kept watching it and thinking. I wish Spike Lee had directed this. And if Spike Lee had directed it, we would have had interviews with people like Eddie Murphy and more people that were more intimate with.
Right.
Fire.
It seems like from what you're saying, just lazy storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. They're cliff notes. She doesn't get a sense of Pryor
at
all.
That's not good. See, the problem with that, though. And this is a big problem. Is someone as iconic as Richard Pryor, that's probably not well known to people that came before, you know, that are younger than us, is that they might take this documentary, if they do happen upon it, and say this is like the be all end all of Richard Pryor, and that would be a shame from what you're saying.
Well, and it's not really that funny either. So you can't really tell why he's funny. Yeah, that's
really
major.
Bad. If it can't get, you know, his humor across to you, then really, what's the point?
Yeah, if you make a documentary about a comedian and it's not funny, there are issues right there.
There was only one part that interested me that I was fascinated by. You know, after his episode where he burned himself.
Oh my God.
He went back and he did the concert film Live on the Sunset Strip. So there's footage in that movie. The concert that you actually see now came out in, I don't know, 83 or something, is the second go-around of him trying
mm-hmm.
that material. The first go around. He failed miserably. And there's footage of him up there, and he knows that he's failing. And he starts to talk to the audience and say, I'm just not feeling it tonight. I'm not doing well. And he's so uncomfortable. And then he just walks off the stage. But then he comes back the next night, and he absolutely kills it. Now, that was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. I saw a really good movie from 2012. I had just recently been reading about the documentary Citizen Coke that had been nixed by the PBS because the Koch brothers, you know.
They wouldn't allow
billionaires
that.
Who give money to PBS would have been incensed. They were incensed by the existence of this documentary. So PBS showed their ass and actually nixed it. But I saw I didn't know about this other documentary that Alex Gibney had done in 2012 called Park Avenue: Money, Power, and the American Dream.
That's the one that's like the precursor to the, because people got really, my mom was telling me because someone in a store, they recorded or something, and they said, well, you don't have our permission to show that or something. And there's a big controversy about this one too, but you got to see it. You're lucky, because I don't think
it's on Hulu.
They're gonna try to, I'm sure. Because this has caused him a lot of controversy.
Well, I'm telling you, it is a damning look at their influence, as well as the influence of Ayn Rand and also of her most powerful acolyte these days, Paul Ryan. What's really fascinating about the film is that it really tries to go down. It doesn't take place in a lot of boardrooms or whatever. It really takes a look at the lives of these billionaires. Like, mm-hmm. What kind of lives did they lead? I mean, to the point where they're going to this specific building in New York City.
Right.
I think it's 740 Park Avenue, which is the building that has the most billionaires in it. And it talks to the doorman of the building and so forth, and you get some kind of insight into what they're like personally, because the movie makes a correlation between Or sets up the relationship between the ultra rich and just the average people.
Yeah, no, that's
what it does. Not even just the ultra poor, but just the average person. And you find that the ultra rich really don't like anybody who's not ultra rich.
Right. No.
They really see everybody as parasites, mm-hmm. and you know they've. I think they'd really like us all like wiped off of the face of the earth.
Well,
I think that's kind of their plan, really.
This is a very controversial documentary, and it's very interesting because I think, you know, you had this also in the New Yorker, this George Packer article about Silicon Valley and the ultra rich there.
Mm-hmm.
That's been making the rounds and causing quite a stir. And I mean, money that we can't, and seeing how they're driving the poor. There's a lot of poor in Silicon Valley too, and they're getting, you know, they're driving them out. And it's really interesting that Silicon Valley, even in the 70s, was not, even in the 80s, was not what it is now. This land of ultra, ultra rich that we can't even comprehend. So I would really love this. We're going to try to watch this documentary, but this documentary got Gibney in a lot of trouble. And rightfully, I'm glad that, you know, he made it, though. Thank God.
Well, I think he courts trouble. I think he likes that.
That's a good documentarian.
I mean, he's going, he did Mea Maxima Culpa, which I haven't seen yet, mm-hmm. but that goes after the Catholic Church. And so he picks big targets. And The movie is incredibly good. It's only a little bit more than an hour long. It is available on Hulu now. It is infuriating. It does leave you with the sense also that there is no way to fix it. Like, there is absolutely no way to fix it. Like, these guys own it. It's done. Over with. There's nothing to do. You can't do. There's not one thing anybody can do about it.
Short of an apocalypse that forces us to start all over again.
Yeah, an apocalypse or a really, really bloody revolution.
But, you know, if God forbid if that ever happened, we'd still end up in the same place. I mean, it's human nature. It's a story of greed. We, you know, it's a part of our DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just weird though too. That I mean, you know, also part of our DNA is kind of helping people. I think that's part of what we are too. And that's where I think these people are like less than human, because they see even giving the doorman more than $25 for the Christmas bonus as being they'd rather
do nothing. Oh my God! Okay.
In some movie news. They're doing this Elton John biopic, Rocket Man, and originally they were talking about Justin Timberlake to star in it as Elton John. Now Elton John apparently wants Thomas Hardy. Is there anyone that – I mean, I guess we're back to the Liberace thing. I mean, people say that Liberace begat Elton John in a big way.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that.
I just have never. I don't know if Thomas Hardy is capable of that level of flamboyance. That's one word that never comes to mind when it comes to Thomas
well,
Hardy.
Well, that will be the challenge then. That will be the real. Although Justin Timberlake is a great choice, though.
I thought Timberlake was a good choice. I still see him as a viable choice. Thomas Hardy doesn't even seem to be in the same body shape or anything. I don't know, though. I mean, is Thomas Hardy like a big buff guy?
Yeah, he's a buff guy, but he could lose. I mean, he could definitely, I'm sure, lose the he could pull a Christian Bale or whatever. And
he'd have to gain some weight. He'd have to gain some weight, or I don't know, because Elton John, for all those early years, was rather dumpy in a lot of ways, you know. He was a little heavy, you know, just
a little bit
chunky, you know. So, and he's just, I don't know, my impression is that he's just generally like a smaller guy. My impression of Thomas Hardy is that he's a big guy.
You know, I think he's multi-talented. I think he's a great entertainer. I'm not sold on Timberlake as an actor. I think he's so-so. I watched Trouble with the Curve finally last night.
Oh, yeah, that was on last night, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually enjoyed it very much. I really enjoyed the father-daughter dynamic in that movie. I thought it was very sweet and touching. But, you know, Timberlake is clearly in that, as is Amy Adams probably, just to work with Clint Eastwood.
Right, yeah.
So I'm sure he got that out of it. But it is one of those thankless roles of the third wheel and the guy that tries to woo the unapproachable woman, you know. But even so, there's something in him that he's not quite there yet. But he's much better than he was in his first movie, which was that dreadful movie Edison Force, where he was so terribly out of his league.
That was such a bad movie. Oh,
my
God.
What movie is this?
Is that the one with Morgan Freeman? Is it Morgan Freeman that's in that?
And Kevin Spacey, yeah. It was the first movie that
Kevin
Spacey did.
Oh,
wow,
boy. That,
I didn't know about that.
That is like, if you want to see Morgan Freeman, Kevin Spacey in a movie that garners, at best, a D-minus, then... That's the one. I'm telling you, they could not save that one.
Reviews come out for Woody Allen's latest movie, Blue Jasmine, and I have a hard time reading whether it's a comedy or a drama, because apparently the first details are coming out about it. It's really a takeoff on the Bernie Madoff scandal, where Alec Baldwin plays the Bernie Madoff type character, and Kate Blanchett, it's about her character
mm-hmm.
trying to come to terms with what her husband's done and reconfigure her life in the midst of this scandal and everybody getting upset at her. That sounds like a drama to me. And then you look and
doesn't
you see,
sound very
you know,
funny.
Then you see Louis C.K. and Andrew Dice Clay are in it, and you're wondering, oh, I wonder what this is. So I'm really majorly interested in it because the review that I read was glowing. I mean, it said that Kate Blanchett is a front runner to be nominated for Best Actress, that people are going to be talking about her character and a lot about the Alec Baldwin character.
Mm-hmm.
So they just didn't say whether it was funny.
Mm.
Woody Allen's been nominated 23 times for an Oscar.
Wow.
It's like a mini Disney, Woody Allen. Can Man of Steel outgross Iron Man 3?
God, is that where is that what everyone's debating now? It might be able to. Who knows?
I don't think so. I don't think so because whatever you want to say about the star system being dead or whatever, or movie stars being, you know, I read an article about, you know, are movie stars, you know, not viable anymore after the failure of After Earth. But when you look at Iron Man, I still think that one of the major draws of Iron Man is Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
So, I mean, he's obviously, you know, a huge, huge star. And,
mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that's missing, I think, from Man of Steel.
Yeah, but he was a known name. He was definitely not an unknown when he did Iron Man. But Iron Man took him to the next level where he became a big movie star.
Yes, but I think that's a major reason that the movie is the series and including the Avengers. I think that's a major reason that those movies are as big of a success as they are. I don't think you can just chalk it down to, oh, well, everybody loves Iron Man. I mean, that's just not true.
No, that's true. That's a good point. But we have to see how – I mean, it really depends. I haven't heard anything about Man of Steel yet to even know, but I think it's a safe bet that it's going to do very well. I don't know if it can do Iron Man 3 numbers, but it might. Who knows? It depends.
I was actually surprised by the numbers that Iron Man 3 has done. But the first screening of Man of Steel will be tomorrow night. I could have gone, but I chose next Monday instead because next Monday is like the IMAX 3D, and I'm
right,
like,
okay.
No, if I'm going to get it for free, I want it with all the bells and whistles, so
right.
I don't have to pay the $20 to go see the whole package. But the word of mouth screenings start tomorrow night, so we'll hear something next week about how good or bad it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Everybody's raving about World War Z.
Good. No, that's good. I think it's great because everyone wanted to write it off so quickly because, oh, it was having trouble. But if what's on screen is good, more power to it. They said they want to make more movies after this, though. That's what I don't know if that's possible.
If it does well, then I'm sure they will. But one of the raves came from Darren Aronofsky that he just said that it's majorly intense, that you know, it's a great, scary movie, that he was scared to death in it. So I guess there's no bad blood between he and Brad Pitt.
I know. That's incredible right there, given what they've been through. But, yeah, I mean, if it's good, and I hope it is because the book's great and they want to make more movies, I hope they can. It just... You know, the way it's sandwiched, though, it's sandwiched in between Man of Steel and it's got to come out against Monsters University. I mean, it's a very crowded time period that it's coming out in.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it comes out the week after Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Then the 21st. And then the 4th of July weekend is Lone Ranger.
And Despicable Me 2, which you're not going to see now.
Mm-mm. How odd is that?
Because Al's not in it.
Yeah. And he backed out like last week.
I know. What was up
and
with
so
that?
They have to they have to completely re-record that performance.
Mm-hmm. Who's playing his part now? Who's doing that?
Benjamin Bratt.
Wow, that how did it go from Pacino to Bratt? Wow.
I mean, they had to do some quick thinking because these voiceovers, I mean, you know that it takes a long time to record mm-hmm. these voices, and they animate around the voice. And so for Pacino to back out like a month and a half before the movie comes out, they had to get the first actor they could find.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's odd. That's odd.
But you saved some money, though. You don't have to go see it now.
Someone back out of an animated movie. Are there, like, creative differences on Despicable Me 2? I mean, come on. My character would not say that. I'm trying to protect the integrity of the character. So Teresa Palmer is a great young actress who you saw her last year. I think it was last year that she starred in Warm Bodies. She was in, previous to that, she was in I Am Number 4. She's in the upcoming Terrence Malick movie. She's actually in a film in limited release right now titled Wish You Were Here. It's a great drama co-starring Joel Edgerton. Tony Farinella, our good buddy, conducted the interview for us. And there's a lot about her approach to acting in this interview. So here is Teresa.
Australian tourist missing for 9 days from a remote Cambodian holiday destination remained unaccounted for despite an extensive search.
Hasn't been anything in the papers, has there?
The passport's still there at the resort.
Yeah, David, John Pinane from the FBA, just trying again. Not sure if you got any of my messages, just hoping you can give me a call as soon as you're able.
Everything okay?
We're having a look at Mr. King's business dealings prior to his trip away.
I know that there is drugs involved, they're going to drop the whole thing. If you don't tell her, I will.
This is about the fact that you are keeping things from me.
Calm down. Calm down.
You get to go home to your kid.
You know, obviously, that if it was going to turn out like this, we would have said something at the time.
Of course. Who was I?
What do you want? No! Come on!
I can't breathe anymore.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for doing this for me. I appreciate it.
Oh, no worries at all.
And my first question for you is, talk to me about this period in your career right now. It seems like you're a part of so many unique and challenging roles. What does it mean to you to find so much interesting work right now?
Look, it's been an incredible time in my life and my career. I feel like I'm heading down yet an even different path. I've kind of forayed into writing and producing, and I'm working on a film at the moment called The Ever After, which is a film that I wrote and produced, and I'm starring in with my partner Mark Webber, who's directing it and starring in it, and we're acting alongside Melissa Leo, which is a complete dream for me. And I'm interested in all facets of filmmaking, and I just loved being a part of a film like Wish You Were Here, which is a great independent drama thriller. It's such a great film.
And with the film I Wish You Were Here, I used to go to some really emotional depths as an actress. How do you get yourself in that state of mind, and how do you prepare for that?
For me, I always know that it's coming up. So I'll look at the schedule at the beginning of the week, and let's say I know that on Thursday I have a very big dramatic scene. I'll mentally prepare myself for that. And then I just lower my energy. I really get into a zone. I listen to a lot of music, and I try and connect with some things in my life that are similar to what this character is going through. And it can be hard, but I can tap into a lot of emotional places relatively easy now. It's like, you just have to practice at it, and you get better and better at it. And when I first started acting, I had to have a tear stick because I was like, I'm not sad. I'm a really happy person. I don't have anything to say. So that would blow this tear stick in my eyes, and I'd just start crying, and I'd pretend I was crying. But now I can really tap into things and actually get these real, raw emotions, which is what I really had to do on this movie.
And you mentioned those raw emotions and going to those places. When you go to those places, after you're done, is it really, I guess, a freeing for you in a way to get all that stuff out of your system?
It is. It is. It's acting. thing is very therapeutic. You get to explore layers of yourself that you know, you don't consciously know are there. It's really very interesting what happens, and it is a release. And, you know, they say, like, all crying is a form of release. So I enjoy it. It's, like, the greatest therapy you can ever have.
And in terms of you and the other actors in this movie, I thought there was such a connection that seemed so authentic. And that really can't be fake, because when you watch a movie, it's like, you can tell whether that's authentic or whether it's artificial. How did you guys find that authenticity as a group?
Well, I really crave and believe and embrace in real. Like, that is my number one thing, authenticity and being genuine. And for me and the rest of this cast, and also even the crew, we wanted it to feel... like, we wanted a sense of togetherness and a sense of community, and so we really hung out with each other a lot and got to know each other and explore each other's personalities and energies and spent so much time together, so that by the time we actually started filming, we were in a really beautiful place to be able to bring to life these real connections. And it's integral to feel like you're all in the same movie and you're all doing the same thing and you are actually very connected. So we just made a point of doing that in real life.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard previous interviews with you where you've mentioned how you remember making $100 a week and how you know that there's no guarantees in Hollywood. Do you still, I guess, sort of worry and have that mindset of you don't know where the next job's going to come from?
Oh, completely. It's funny. I never thought, you know, 5 years ago, I never thought that at this point in my career, I would still be worrying where my next job's going to be coming from. But to be honest, it's all relative. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you always have to make sure you're choosing the right projects and you're in quality things. And it can be difficult. And I've been very lucky that, you know, Warm Body has definitely opened the door for me. And I've had more opportunities since then. But I still always worry, you know, is anyone going to want to cast me in a film? When's my next job going to come? And for me, it's been liberating creating my own opportunities by writing and producing films. And that is this newfound passion of mine. I love creating my own stories. And I think that's something I'm going to continue to really put all my focus into in the future.
In terms of other challenging work, in terms of being complex and interesting, you have worked with Terrence Malick. So I have to ask you, what were your first impressions of him, and what makes him so unique as a filmmaker, in your opinion?
He is such a sweet man. He is gentle and kind and passionate and quirky, and I was just really bowled over by his energy and his spirit, and he's just this wonderful artist. And he really put his faith in me as an actor. He wanted me to essentially play a version of myself, and it was the best experience I've ever had on a film set. And we would arrive on the day, we wouldn't really know what we were doing. We just knew the space that we had to work in, and we could move in and out in front of the camera, run off, and then run back in again and say whatever we wanted and improvise. And he would give us these pages at the beginning of the day, and they would serve as a launching off point for improvisation. And sometimes you'd run off and Terrence would whisper something in your ear, tell you to say something, and you run back into frame and say that thing and then start going off on a tangent. And it was just a really interesting way of filmmaking, and it was very guerrilla style and authentic and real and spontaneous, and it breathed life back into me in a sense. It really reinvigorated my passion in filmmaking.
You mentioned your passion for filmmaking and for acting also. I want to ask you, moving to Los Angeles, how did that change your career?
I think it was integral for me to move to LA. I was living in Adelaide, South Australia, and there's really no work in Adelaide for an actor. And I came out to Cannes. I was at Cannes Film Festival in 2006, and an American agent decided to sign me from Cannes. I was in a film there called 237, and then I moved out to LA, and it's just logistically it's a lot easier to be auditioning and driving from meeting to meeting and trying to put yourself out there to get work. It's a lot harder putting yourself on tape from Australia, and then if you do get a call back, you have to get on a 15-hour flight and fly into LA and then deal with jet lag and then have to be on point for this 1 hour session that you have to really prove your worth as an actor. It was too much, so the move felt imperative for me.
I also read in previous interviews how at one point you were interested in journalism and you were pursuing that. Because of that background and history, does this sort of give you a different appreciation for what people, I guess, sort of like how they have to prepare for interviews and do it? Does it give you a certain, I guess, a different appreciation for what journalists do?
Yeah, definitely. I did journalism at school for 18 months, and I have a certificate for media studies. So I know how much of a challenging job it is and how journalists are under the pump constantly, and it is a creative job. You guys can get to create all these amazing questions and, you know, that spark people's thoughts, and it's just a really cool job. I really gravitated towards it, and I think it has helped me in terms of just putting my trust in journalists, and I understand that they're wanting to make like a dynamic story. They're wanting to write something interesting that readers are going to feel connected to, and I appreciate that. So I think in my answers, I always try and tell each journalist something different or a new story, and I don't just say the same things over and over.
Okay, that was Teresa Palmer. The movie is Wish You Were Here. It's in limited release right now. Let me see if there's a website that I can give you guys to go to find out more about it. It has an official Facebook and Twitter page, and you can also read more about it at wishyouwerehere.thefilm.com.
Cool.
There you go. So, let's close off the show with a piece of film score from World War Z.
Oh, who does the music for World War Z?
Marco,
I think it's Marco
Beltrami.
Yeah, yeah, it's Marco Beltrami.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So I've gotten tons of new soundtracks lately, and none of them have a theme. Like, there's nothing in any of these scores that you can hum.
That's just the way scores are now. They're just noise. It's ridiculous. I haven't been excited by a score in maybe since Social Network.
Yeah. You know, I'm very wistful for the days when movies had a theme that you could hold on to. I bemoan the passing of that tradition where you had something that you could identify with characters and exciting moments, and you could take them with you in the form of a hummable melody. Anyway, okay. By the way, that's not the music to World War Z that I just played. Just to let you guys
okay,
know.
All right. I didn't think
it
was.
That's the sound of an oncoming zombie, that piano. So, man, this movie's intense. All right. All right, guys. So next Sunday, we'll be
all right,
back at
awesome.
Next Sunday.
Have a good one.
All right, you too.
You too.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
See you guys.